I want to focus today on how we at ICE are going about redefining sound immigration enforcement. I also want to leave some time for anybody who has questions. Ask away. Believe me, at this point, there's no question you can't ask, that even if you think it's a shocking one. I'll do my best to answer as candidly as I can. If I don't know the answer, I'll tell you. First, a very brief bit about me and about ICE. Now, who is John Morton? Well, I was born in another country, in Scotland. I'm the proud son of an immigrant. My mother is a lawful permanent resident to this day, 45 years after she came to the United States from England as a young woman after her parents had been killed. My first job, as David told you, was as a Peace Corps volunteer. My second job was as an INS trial attorney, and here I find myself all those years later running ICE, one of the largest enforcement agencies in the federal government. So now some of you might think to yourself, gee, that's kind of odd, you know, that a Peace Corps volunteer ends up, who was born in Inverness, Scotland, to someone who's not an American, would end up a federal prosecutor and then ultimately the head of ICE. I got to say, I don't in the end. Indeed, I think that sort of my background and who I am represent at once two of the more important qualities that make our country great. We are a nation of immigrants, a nation whose tradition of immigration is has made us strong, it's made us vibrant, has made us innovative. And we're also a nation of laws, laws that are followed, laws that give us integrity and resilience as a nation, laws that allow us to be free and forceful as a people. So I take great pride in the work that ICE does, even though it's in a very difficult space. As a nation, we need integrity in our customs and immigration systems. We need control over our borders. We need to investigate and prosecute drug traffickers and counterfeiters and alien smugglers and child sex tourists. We need an ICE. Now, what is ICE? In the public imagination, and indeed within much of government, ICE is thought of as the country's immigration enforcement agency. In fact, ICE is much more than that. It is one of the largest law enforcement agencies in the federal government, indeed in the world, with a wide array of criminal and civil powers, many of them having absolutely nothing to do with immigration. We are the second largest criminal investigative agency in the United States, behind only the FBI. We have roughly 7,000 special agents stationed in every single state in the Union and 47 countries overseas. These 7,000 agents aren't involved in removing immigrants from the United States. Rather, they investigate and prosecute criminals, regardless of nationality, who engage in transnational crime. Criminals like drug traffickers and money launderers, international art thieves. I just returned three stolen paintings this year to the French government, been taken after the First and Second World War, something that people don't appreciate that we do. We investigate child pornographers. We bring more child pornography cases each year than any other federal agency in the government, including the FBI. Sex traffickers and sex tourists, alien smugglers, international weapons brokers, counterfeiters, and intellectual property thieves. We're the principal investigators of counterfeiting in the country. Now, of course, we do play a significant role in civil immigration enforcement, even though those duties only account for half of our personnel. In particular, we are responsible for most immigration enforcement within the interior of the country, and we have the principal, the exclusive authority for immigration detention, formal removal proceedings, and worksite enforcement. Indeed, we maintain over 33,000 detention beds on any given day, and we remove a little less than 400,000 people a year from the country, both all-time records for the country. Both of those records aren't the full story, however, of the past 3 years at ICE, and that's what I want to talk about. What has been going on at ICE during this administration is much, much more profound than that. We are literally redefining the face of immigration enforcement, a redefinition that for the first time commits the agency to enforcement that is measured, sensible, and effective. Now, you might ask yourself, well, why was redefinition necessary in the first place? Well, here's why. Immigration is an issue that our country has wrestled with for years, and we haven't been able to come to a national consensus. Just haven't been able to get it right. Our present immigration laws do not work well and are badly in need of reform. Almost everyone agrees that reform is necessary. But the devil is in the details, and there are strong, strong disagreements about what the reform should look like. There are now an estimated 11 million people in the country unlawfully. Many of them have been in the United States for decades, some of them since their early childhood. Yet ICE has sufficient resources to remove about 400,000 people a year. That's less than 4% of the people who are here unlawfully. And in these difficult budget times, it is very, very unlikely that ICE's budget, already at an all-time high, will increase substantially in the years to come. So the question then isn't, why isn't ICE deporting everyone who is in the country illegally? Why isn't ICE removing 11 million people? That's simply not possible as the agency is structured or as the agency is funded. And even if we were funded to achieve that kind of enforcement result, I'm telling you as the head of the agency, I don't think that an enforcement-only solution makes lasting sense, particularly for illegal immigrants who have lived here for many decades and have American children, American spouses, houses, three cars in the driveway, and a mortgage. So if ICE can only remove 400,000 people a year, the real question has to be, who are those 400,000 people going to be? It's not going to be 11 million people, it's going to be 400,000. And who are those 400,000 people going to be? Should they be the first 400,000 people we encounter, regardless of circumstance? In other words, should the question be whether ICE removes the first 400,000 people in the front door? Well, from my perspective, that just can't be the right answer. Just can't be. The 400,000 people that we remove each year have to be those that make sense from the perspective of good policy and good government. To me, good policy and good government call for enforcement that promotes public safety, border security, and the integrity of our immigration controls. In practice, what does that amount to? Well, it amounts to a focus on the following three categories of immigration violators. First and foremost, criminal offenders. It makes absolute sense to direct our limited resources to the removal of those who are here, not only unlawfully, but are committing crimes at the same time. We do this primarily by identifying people who are held in the nation's prisons and jails, increasingly through our biometric identification program known as Secure Communities, which I'll touch on further in a moment. Our second priority must be the removal of recent border crossers. If we are to maintain any kind of basic border control, we must arrest and remove those we encounter entering illegally at the border or at airports. Think about it. If we don't do that, there is no sense in having a visa system, right? But we do have one, right? And it's worldwide. You got to get a visa to come to the United States. You got to ask, in most instances, for permission to come here, and there is a whole system set up in place as to how long you can stay and when you got to go home. And if we're not going to have basic enforcement there, that whole system doesn't make any sense. Our third priority focuses on immigration fugitives and illegal reentrants. That is, those people who knowingly flout an immigration judge's order, either by fleeing, absconding when they first get it, or when they're deported, coming back illegally after that deportation. Again, if we are going to have any kind of a credible immigration enforcement system, we have to take final orders of removal seriously. We spend billions of tax dollars each year to obtain these orders. Money for immigration and border patrol officers, on detention space for ICE trial attorneys, for DOJ immigration judges. If we aren't going to enforce these orders, what is the purpose of the employment of all of those people and the expenditure of so much in the way of government resources? Again, and we're not talking about a rounding error of $10 million. We're talking about billions upon billions of dollars each year We spend close to $2 billion on detention alone, and that's not factoring in salaries. It's not factoring in all the many actors in the other departments that have to come together to achieve a removal order. So I outlined these priorities in June of 2010 in very clear terms for our agents, our officers, and our attorneys. And these priorities now govern how we spend our time and our money, or to put it into more direct enforcement terms, whom we arrest, whom we detain, whom we remove. The results of this focus are clear. In a mere 3 years, which in government terms is a very, very short period of time, we have increased the removal of criminals from this country by over 80%, from 114,000 in fiscal year 2008 to 216,000 criminal offenders this past year. And I don't think we are that far from the day when ICE removes a quarter of a million criminal offenders from the country each year. So, as you can see from this chart, criminal offenders now make up 55% of the people we remove. Criminals are in red. And contrary to what you hear quite often, non-criminal removals are not at an all-time high. In fact, there's been a steady decrease. So what we're really talking about is, again, not absolute numbers going through the roof, but rather a reorientation, a refocus on who's actually removed from the country. And so while we do continue to remove large numbers of non-criminals, those we remove increasingly fall within our priorities, as I just outlined. For instance, many of those who are removed without a conviction are fugitives or illegal reentrants. Others are arrested near the border and placed in expedited removal proceedings. And let's take a look at who these non-criminals are and how they fit into our other priorities. So this is a chart of everyone we removed last year. So you have criminal offenders at 55%. Repeat immigration violators is the next largest category, read illegal reentrance. Border removals, people captured by the Border Patrol and referred to us, or captured by CBP at the airport and referred to us. Immigration fugitives, that is people who had an order and decided to abscond. And the last is the other category. So as you can see from this chart, we are in fact focused on our priorities. Less than 10% of the people we removed from the country were not within our highest priorities. And this year, that number is 7.5% of the people we removed. So at the end of this next fiscal year, we're going to reduce the number of sort of general other even further. I've been in government my whole career, and I tell you this degree of focus is remarkable, and it belies the idea that ICE is off enforcing the law willy-nilly, or we're targeting families and children and the like. It's just simply not true. We're focusing our efforts like never before, and a dramatic shift in real terms is underway. One reason that we've been able to shift the agency's enforcement priorities and results so dramatically in a short period of time is a renewed emphasis on prosecutorial discretion. That power, in basic terms, is the power to decline to pursue an individual case due to limited resources or public policy. And it has long been a fundamental fixture of the criminal justice system. And as part of our drive to focus our limited resources on our priorities, the Secretary and I have reemphasized the power in the civil immigration context as well. And to that end, I issued a memorandum in June of last year listing various factors our officers and attorneys should consider when deciding whether or not to pursue somebody. Right? And getting up and saying, we aren't going to remove everybody. We're only going to remove 400,000 people. And we're going to focus on people that make sense. And in order to do that, we're going to give instructions to people on here are our priorities and here are characteristics that people have that don't justify the limited use of our resources. So, who are low priority people from our perspective? We have long-term residence with a USC relative and compelling ties or contributions to the country. Somebody's been here 15 years, has two USC children, a USC spouse, car in the driveway, right? When it comes down to deciding are they going to be in the 400,000, the answer is no. No, they don't have a criminal record. Children in school or with a high school degree. I'd rather go after criminal offenders with my limited resources. People with a serious mental or physical condition. One, just doesn't make sense to try to deport somebody with terminal cancer in the first place. And second, there's a very real operational reason why we wouldn't do that. When you detain somebody like this, it's incredibly expensive. Think of all of the amount of medical care that goes into dealing with somebody who's seriously handicapped. Well, what sense does it make to spend the taxpayers' money on that? You have a single case can eat up $1 million in no time. Well, we could spend $1 million removing 30 murderers or terrorists. And that's the right answer. Does that mean that we're leaving somebody in the country unlawfully? Of course, but we've been doing that for 20 years. We have victims of domestic violence, trafficking under serious crime, lawful permanent residents here for a long time, veterans. You know, do we really need to focus on veterans or their spouses, assuming they don't have a criminal record? No. People who are over 65, right? Should that be a priority for us? No. Doesn't mean we're not going to ever enforce the law against these people, but it means that they're not going to be within our priorities when we have to make hard calls each year about who the 400,000 are going to be. To make sure that this is happening, I've instructed Peter and the rest of our attorneys to review the 300,000 plus cases that are pending in the immigration court system. And I want them to identify any cases that are on this list or that otherwise don't make sense so that we can close them. And we can focus the existing immigration enforcement docket on our priorities. The immigrants in these closed cases aren't going to be granted permanent status in the United States, but they will not be immediately removed absent changed circumstances, such as a criminal arrest or a conviction. In essence, we're going to suspend their removal. So far, we've reviewed about 120,000 cases. We got 180,000 to go. It's a Herculean task, first time the government has ever undertaken something like this. But we think it's the right call. There's no sense in pretending that a 300,000 case backlog that stretches as far as the eye can see is not something that we need to deal with in an honest and sober fashion, so that's what we've done. A quick word on secure communities. As I mentioned earlier, I believe that criminal offenders are a very sensible focus for our enforcement efforts. And think about this. In some parts of the country, the recidivism rate is over 50%. When you have a recidivism rate that is that high, that means one out of every two criminals released to the street will reoffend within a matter of a few years. Not a good thing if you live in the community where that release occurs. So when we focus our enforcement efforts on criminals, we significantly disrupt this pattern of recidivism. If we identify offenders in prison while they're serving their time and remove them before they are released to the streets, there are no new offenses in that community from those removed. That's a really, really powerful force for public safety, particularly when you consider that we removed 216,000 criminal offenders from the United States and we're on our way to 250,000. That's simply good policy. It's simply good law enforcement. If you were to apply the rate of 50% to the 260,000 people that we removed last year, right, you can do the math. That's 108,000 criminal offenses that are not going to occur over the next three-year period. I don't think there's a law enforcement agency in the country that can have that kind of dramatic effect on public safety as ICE. So anything we can do to identify deportable criminals before their release makes sense, and that's exactly what Secure Communities does. It's simply a program by which the FBI and ICE share fingerprint information for immigration enforcement purposes. Under Secure Communities, what we do is we run the fingerprints taken when people are booked in for a criminal arrest, and we check them against our databases at the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security to see if the person has a criminal record and whether they're not in the country, if they're in the country illegally. If the person is indeed here illegally and either has a criminal conviction, has been deported before, or has an outstanding order as an immigration fugitive, we focus on them. The check is completely independent of the underlying arrest, and it requires no additional action by the arresting officer. And contrary to what many allege, only a criminal arrest triggers a secure communities check, nothing else. And everyone's fingerprints are checked upon arrest, whether you're a citizen, a lawful immigrant, or an undocumented immigrant. If I get arrested, my fingerprints get checked. Only ICE determines whether or not to deport the person at the end of the day. And contrary to the high rhetoric you may hear, Secure Communities does not authorize local police officers to engage in immigration enforcement in any way, period. In fact, Secure Communities does not change the existing process of arrests by state and local law enforcement at all. It is simply a means by which ICE uses information already gathered through the FBI system to focus our immigration enforcement efforts on the criminal justice system. Now, to date, we have deployed Secure Communities to over 2,000 jurisdictions in 43 states. So that's well past the 50% mark. The number of jurisdictions in the United States is a little over 3,000. And we should be fully deployed by 2013. And as Secure Communities reaches full deployment, I think you will see a continued increase in the number of criminal aliens identified and removed by ICE, with a corresponding downward pressure on the crime rate in the communities involved. Indeed, I think it likely, as I mentioned before, that we're going to be close to 250,000 removals a year here in short order, much of that driven by Secure Communities. For the first time, we are in jails and prisons identifying people for release in a way that we never were before. It's the first truly comprehensive identification program for the criminal justice system that the agency has ever had. All right, before I take some questions, let me say a few words on another critical area of reform under this administration, and that is detention reform. When I took office, many criticized our detention system as sprawling, unresponsive, and too closely mirrored on the penal system. It's a very odd structure at ICE. We run a very large detention system. As I said, we have 33,000 detention beds on any given day, which is huge. We have facilities throughout the country. But it's a civil power, right? We are detaining people solely for the purposes of immigration enforcement, civil immigration enforcement, namely for purposes of removal, and for no other reason. We're not a penal institution. We don't incarcerate people. We deal with a lot of people who are criminals, but they're not in our detention space because they need to be punished in some way for that underlying crime. So while our detention system is civil in nature, the way it has been built over the last 20 years has largely been on the back of the criminal justice system. This is because there was an explosion in the size of our civil detention resources. And civil detention is a fairly unique bird in the United States. There are not a lot of other instances. There are some civil detention for people who have severe mental problems, for example. But ordinarily, when you detain people, you detain them for criminal justice reasons. So when I got into office, we took these criticisms to heart, and we have engaged in a steady overhaul of the system, an overhaul that seeks to redesign our detention practices in light of what our authority is, and that is civil, not criminal, detention. 3 years into the effort, great progress has been made. A lot more needs to be done. This is something that is going to have to outlast me and my time as the director of the agency. The system was built up over decades. It's going to take decades to get to where I have in my mind, but we really have made enormous strides in the past 3 years, and a couple of examples of that. One of the biggest criticisms of ICE when I came in was that we had too many people who died in our custody. In 2004, we detained 21,928 people, and we had the highest numbers of deaths in our custody in modern times, 28. And as you can see, in the last 3 years, we've never had a year over 10 people in our custody. Yet, we have increased the amount of people in detention by 50%. So we're detaining way, way, way more people, yet far few of them are dying in our custody. We have a very open and transparent process now. The second somebody dies in our custody, we put everything on the website, we notify everybody, we notify the Inspector General, and that sort of sunshine has been the best disinfectant. And if you were to look behind the numbers now, a lot of people die in our custody because they had terminal cancer, they had some pre-existing medical condition, they came from a country in which it was either not able to be addressed or in many instances, they didn't even know they were ill. And then they come into our system and we determine that they have a life-threatening illness. Many of the people in our custody have never seen a dentist before they came to us. And we provide that first trip to the dentist. We've reduced the number of facilities we use from 341. Believe it or not, when I first got here, we had 341 different facilities we were detaining people in to 250. Needs to go down even further. That's still a very large number. But only 160 of the ones that we use now are used to detain people longer than 72 hours. And only 126 have more than 10 detainees on average at any given time. So we've been able to make extreme progress here. We got a lot more progress to make. I'll be frank with you, one of the challenges for us is that everybody's for detention reform except when it's in their backyard. And the reason for that is we're an enormous employer. Most of the detention facilities that we use are not owned and operated by the federal government. There are state and local detention facilities in which we rent space, and very few people want to see those jobs leave their jurisdiction through consolidation into larger facilities. We created an online detainee locator system that allows anyone, family members, lawyers, and advocates, to locate someone in our custody. Before, you had to call us, you had to search around, you had to hope you knew where the person we were detaining was. Now you can go on the web. Anyone here can do it. You know the person's name, you go on the web, you figure out where they're detained. We'll tell you what facility is, how you get there, what the telephone number is, what the visiting hours are, what it looks like. The system is visited more than 100,000 times a month. It's been a tremendous reform. And the next version of it is going to send emails to people's attorneys and family members if they're moved or there's any kind of change automatically. This month, I'm going to cut the ribbon at our new detention facility in Karnes, Texas, which is right here. And the reason that this facility is important is because it's the first facility we designed from scratch as a civil detention center. Right? This didn't exist. This was an empty field a year ago. It wasn't designed to be a prison. It's not going to be used to be a prison. Even if we leave, it's a civil detention center. It features open spaces, dorm rooms, and free movement. You know, people can go around and spend time outside as long as they don't try to jump the fence. We're all good. So what does the future hold? Well, I think the Congress needs to enact comprehensive immigration reform. The present system doesn't work well, and I got to be frank with you, in my view, is unsustainable over the long run. And we can't keep kicking the can down the road, which is what we've been doing for a long time, decades now. In the meantime, that leaves ICE and the Department of Homeland Security making the best of an imperfect world. And for me, that means we focus on our priorities. We continued detention reform, and we exercise good judgment. At the end of the day, you know, what do people expect of us? What does the average American expect of us? That we exercise good judgment We focus on things that make sense. We treat people well. We don't give away the store, but we're not, disorganized and rambling in our enforcement efforts. Let me close with a few thoughts on the job for you, just to give you some perspective of what it's really like. Again, being frank, being the head of ICE is not an easy job. I will please and displease some person, some legislator, some editorial board or an advocacy group each and every day. There are many people who would have me do things differently. This comes with the territory. I am not an advocate. I'm in the business of governing. And with governance comes the delicate duty of balancing competing interests, the law, resources, discretion, common sense, all for the greater good. And at the end of the day, my basic approach to the job is simple. I try to make the calls on the merits. I'm not a hard partisan. I'm just trying to get it right for the government, for the country, and for all the people, citizens and immigrants alike, that ICE touches each day. Now, you definitely don't please everyone. And just to give you a little illustration of that point, here is a recent missive from a citizen concerned that we at ICE are, let's just say, off on the wrong track. So if you can see this here, I'll read it to you. I've had to edit parts of it because we have a family audience here tonight. What part of illegal don't you understand, you liberal Obama blank-kissing son of a blank? This is my children's country you're messing with. You have no right to give it away. Prosecute and deport all, underscored twice just to make sure I got that point, illegal immigrants with a double exclamation. 1.5 million legal and 3.5 million illegal immigrants every year is unsustainable. Now, to be fair, I get this, I think, person is generally writing from a perspective largely associated with the extreme right. I get plenty of these associated from the extreme left saying that I am being too hard. But for every one of the salvos I get, and I get a lot of them, I have a secret antidote for my sanity that I will share with you here in our last 30 seconds before I take any questions from you. It, too, is a letter trying to persuade me to change my position and cave on a long-running dispute. And I got this letter in the mail out of the blue last year, and to my great surprise, it was written by none other than my 7-year-old daughter, Lucy. And even though I didn't cave in to its not so subtle manipulation, as you'll see, it cheers me up no matter what. And so if I'm ever having a day where I get too many of these, I just look at this. I'll read it for you. It says, "Dear Daddy, please listen." An interesting spelling on listen. "Daddy, this is one for you. I love you." She's obviously sophisticated in the art of manipulation, knowing it's a good thing to start up with a father with an unbridled statement of love. "Dad, want a pet, one I can play with, then can sleep the night away. It's a dog. Please love your sad child." And then just to make sure that I get the point, "Thank you," and an idyllic setting with her stick father, her stick self, and our new dog with its four legs and long tail. And she'd been after me and has been after me for a dog for quite some time. So, folks, there are ups and downs in this job, but in the end, there are more ups than downs. And I think few can quarrel with the idea that we at ICE and DHS have brought a thoughtful, sort of reform-based agenda to the agency. I think the results speak for themselves. Again, plenty of people can have different views on exactly how we should have gone about things, but I don't think people can seriously claim that we haven't been thoughtful and studious in what we've been trying to achieve. We have hardly abandoned enforcement, as many claim. We've removed more people from the country than any other time in the agency's history. And we aren't targeting families and children, as others might have you believe. What we've done is to refocus enforcement in a sober, sensible way. And in short, we have changed the face of immigration enforcement in a pretty short period of time, and I would argue for the better. So with that, I thank you all very much for your attention. I am so happy to be back at the law school, although, as I was telling someone earlier, it looks a lot more like the Ritz-Carlton than it does the law school I knew back in the day, and I'm happy to take any questions that people have.